Okay, well, I don't want to say this is my last time with you, because it won't be. It's just for this season, but during the regular school year, I think of it as a school year, I won't be here, but then I'll be back in the summer. I'm here, yes, I'm here, but just not here, yeah. Yeah, well, I think so, but my sanity, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, that I'm taking a little bit of a break from teaching during the 9 months of the school year, just because I'm teaching, well, this fall, 7 classes, and I don't know how many hours per week, but anyway, that's it's going to be too much for me to try to prepare on Saturday, and I have some responsibilities on Saturday now, too, with some online and distance things, so... Anyway, so yes, I'm taking that break. However, summertime, I'm much more freed up, so I'll probably be with you straight through the summer, like no breaks, just, you know, 3 months or so. I can do a whole series that way, so that would be much easier than the on and on again, off again. I've attempted this for years, you know, for a long time. I was just teaching once a month, and then it became twice a month, thanks to Brad talking me into it over and over for several years before I said yes. But I'm finding that my schedule is just tearing me in different directions. So you will see me in the choir. I said that last week, but that's not the same as what I'm doing here. It's more relaxing in some ways and not quite as intense as far as studying. All right, well, it is very typical of me to bite off more than I can chew when it comes to some texts and some things that I want to do. So I am not going to assume that I'm going to be able to do too much justice to the rest of Zephaniah. Normally, when I teach this book on the college level, usually I have about three or four lectures, and they're 2.5 hours each, so with some breaks. But yeah, so I'm trying to condense all of this in less than 2 hours, and I spent so much time setting up the book of Zephaniah that I only made it through 13 verses. So I'll do what I can to get through, but it's not speed that's the issue. It's more just the main content. The other thing is I was taught in speech communications, and this is true for all communications, really. If what you have to say can't be said in less than half the time, then you're not much of a communicator. Tell that to preachers, by the way, sometimes. But yes, so the main point is what you really need to grasp when you're looking at Zephaniah. And the main idea, we're getting to it today because we're starting in verse 14 of chapter 1, but the day of the Lord is the main idea of Zephaniah. If you were just going to summarize it as a phrase, it is all about the day of the Lord. There is another minor prophet that focuses exclusive attention on the day of the Lord, and that's Joel. But they're doing it from two different perspectives. Joel is looking at an event that has just taken place that pictures the day of the Lord. It's essentially God's judgment bringing in justice, perfect justice, but just on a small scale. When you look at the history of God's dealings with man in his sin, it usually revolves around three different points. He deals with sin on an individual level. So once in a while, you will get individuals who are judged for their sin or punished or disciplined. We get that occasionally. Those are the ones that stand out to us because we think of names like David, for example, or something like that. We think of specific people. But then there is the judgment on groups, where he will go after groups. Sometimes they're nations, sometimes they're groups within a nation, but he will go after groups of people. And then there is really, in history, there are only two, and that is two events that involve universal judgment. That is all of mankind. the one event you have already encountered when we were in Genesis, and that's Genesis 6 through 8, but the flood. That was the time when God dealt with all of mankind together. There is another event that is prophesied, and that's what this day of the Lord is about, where God will execute perfect justice on all of humanity. And that's what we're looking forward to. When we see evil in the world, when we see the effects of sin, it's nice to see God bringing justice on individual levels. It's good to see it on larger levels. And we've had different cases within history where we've seen that take place. World War II stands out in my mind for like a, you know, larger group. But then we have this time that we are looking forward to when God is going to bring in perfect justice. All of us become frustrated when we see the world around us and we see the effects of sin. And when we see leadership in places where we don't think it should be. Don't be alarmed, that's been happening throughout history. And that you have evil that rises up and gains power over those who are devoted to the Lord. And that happens time and again. And essentially, all of these prophets are telling us that's not going to stop. That's going to continue on. And anyone who thinks that that's going to be fixed in our time without the return of Christ, you just need to recognize that's not going to happen. It is only when Christ returns that we are going to have the perfection of the justice that we've been longing for all this time. So with Zephaniah, he is moving between two of those elements. He's not looking at the individuals. Some prophets do. Actually, if we continued on with Jeremiah where we left off, it would be going after each of the kings that is leading the people in the wrong direction. But this is going to be after groups and the universal, the larger one. So it's moving between those two poles. Now, verse 14, just to set you up, though, the universal begins immediately in chapter 1, which is sounds like a repetition of the flood. I will sweep away man and beast. You know, I'll sweep away everything. In other words, this will be universal, and I will cut off mankind from the face of the earth. But then in verse 4, he says specifically Judah and Jerusalem. And remember that Zephaniah is in the same time period as Jeremiah. He's in the early part of Jeremiah's ministry, and really under a good king. Josiah was the last good king of Judah who brought many reforms. The unfortunate thing is that the reforms didn't sink deep into the people's hearts. They were just external. And so when Josiah was off the scene, then they went back to their sin again. But Judah is targeted here because that is his context. And he mentions those who bow down on the roofs, the hosts of heaven, and also the name Milcom shows up in verse 5. That's the one where they had sacrifices, child sacrifice to the god of the Ammonites. That's who that is. And that was taking place during this time. And we saw some of the horrors of that in Jeremiah. That's what made Jeremiah kind of difficult for me to even teach, because I'm thinking, how in the world can we even picture this? All of the things that were going on. And the sad thing is that these were God's people in the sense that they were the covenant people of God, the ones that were set apart to be different from everyone else, and then they fall into this. So the day of the Lord then is mentioned in verse 7, and the Lord speaks of it as a sacrifice. He actually does this also in Joel. So Joel also brings up this idea that it's a feast. But it's not the kind of feast that you want to necessarily be a part of if you're on the wrong side of this. The feast in Joel is it's a feast for the birds of prey who will eat the carcasses of those who die. So that's a little stronger. This, though, is a feast that is a victory celebration that justice has been brought to bear. But it's a day of sacrifice, and the sacrifice is going to be, notice in verse 8, the officials, the king's sons, those who are connected to the leadership of Judah. And we saw at the very beginning of Zephaniah, Zephaniah seems to be in the royal line. Now, he's not, you know, up to be the next king because he's not in that category. He's not like the son of Josiah, but he is connected to Hezekiah. And so he is part of the royalty, or at least the royal family. That might tell us something about why he says certain things. I'll also mention it probably tells us why he doesn't say certain things. There's a strange absence in this book on the kings. Now, of course, Josiah is good, so that's understandable. But it not the mention of specific names, whereas Jeremiah kind of, you know, he tells you the names of the people. But then we have this kind of woe. On that day, a cry will be heard. And then I mentioned that all of these sections here seem to be about the markets, the trade, the economics. It's a strange phenomenon in society that when you do have people who are only thinking of themselves, money always comes into it somehow, or economics. I want more, and I don't care who I step on to get it, or who I, you know, use to get it. And this kind of corruption was going on. So he identifies that specifically. But when we get to verse 14, now we're stepping back once again, kind of to the big picture. And it says in verses 14 to 16, the great day of the Lord is near, near and hastening fast. The sound of the day of the Lord is bitter. The mighty man cries aloud there. A day of wrath is that day, a day of distress and anguish, a day of ruin and devastation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet blast and battle cry against the fortified cities and against the lofty battlements. Now that you could just say that whole section is the war cry. It's the it's very common for armies before they attacked. They might sit there in a siege for a long time. But when you hear that loud yell and the trumpet blast, they're coming. I mean, it's happening right then. And so this is preparing, hopefully, the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem that the Lord is coming. Now, what are they doing? What are the people in Judah and Jerusalem doing? Well, according to Jeremiah, they've decided that if the Lord hasn't done anything, then he doesn't care. So long enough time has passed, he hasn't acted, therefore he doesn't care what we're doing. Therefore, we can do whatever we want. And so apathy comes in. The New Testament, you have the exact same thing. In 2 Peter, it tells us that there are those who will say, where's the promise of his coming? Well, he hasn't come yet, so he's certainly not coming. Therefore, we can do whatever we want. Now, that was in the first century. We are 2,000 years past that, before the second coming of Christ. Can you imagine what people think nowadays? And the tendency of people to think, well, he hasn't shown up yet, so what makes you think he will? He has said that he's coming. And he said that he is going to bring justice, but it hasn't happened yet. So there's a tendency for us to just think, well, he's not going to. And in our sin nature, what will happen is that if we get to that apathetic stage, apathy is going to lead to sin, because then we're just going to think, well, then if everyone else can get away with all this corruption, why can't I? And every one of us has that sin in us to bring us to that point. It's something we always need to watch out for. It's a lonely life, according to the Old Testament especially, but also just look at Christ. It's a lonely life to be devoted to the Lord and to stick to it, to remain faithful to him, because all of the pressures around us are telling us to do otherwise. And there's enough hypocrisy among God's people that we could just fall into step with that and just become hypocrites. And everyone sees us worshiping on Sunday and everything looks fine, but on the inside, it's not that way. That's exactly what was going on in Judah at the time. Now notice he goes to the universal in verse 17. I will bring distress on mankind so that they shall walk like the blind because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be poured out like dust and their flesh like dung. Neither their silver nor their gold shall be able to deliver them on the day of the wrath of the Lord. In the fire of his jealousy, all the earth shall be consumed. For a full and sudden end he will make of all the inhabitants of the earth. That is all universal language. It is the same kind of language that was used for the flood. But there is coming a day when he is going to do this universally. I at least would like to move far enough into this book to get to the positive, just so I can leave you with that. I don't want to leave you with this. But that for those who are devoted to the Lord and have been longing for his return, you know, the come quickly, Lord Jesus, this should be comfort for us. It should be security for us to know that the things that need to be fixed can't be fixed by any of our human leaders or any of our governments. They can only be truly fixed by Jesus himself when he returns. That's the only way that this is going to happen. Vote as you desire. Support people that you think are going to be better than others, sometimes lesser of evils, but otherwise just do what you want on that level, but just know that mankind, until the problem of sin is dealt with, mankind will continue to be unjust, oppressive, and violent towards others. That will not change, okay? We need to keep that in mind. Now, chapter 2, it's interesting that from chapter 2 forward, even though he's already mentioned Judah and Jerusalem, he changes to almost couched terms now with Judah. It's clear he's still talking about them, but remember, his scope is universal. So if his scope is universal, and this is designed for, you know, as it's been preserved for us, to work in many different contexts, he doesn't actually say Judah when we get to chapter 2. But it's clear that we're dealing with those who are part of God's people. Listen to these words. Gather together, yes, gather, O shameless nation, before the decree takes effect, before the day passes away like chaff, before there comes upon you the burning anger of the Lord, before there comes upon you the day of the anger of the Lord. So 2 days are mentioned here. There's a day that's passing away and a day that's coming. So you have to think of days not in the 24-hour sense, but we are talking about periods of time. There's a period of time when there is a chance that you can repent. You'll know these words. It comes from Joel when he's speaking of that time period, that in-between time period before the day of the Lord comes. The message that should go out to everyone is everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. That's the message. I know you know it from Paul. You know it from Peter, but it's from Joel, and it's about the day of the Lord. It's the time period before this final judgment that is the message. And that's the message that Jesus himself left with us. This is why it's so important that the church, is not to be inward, but to be outward. Yes, there's worship and fellowship, and those are the glorious parts of church, I'll admit. You know, I look forward to the worship. I look forward to the fellowship. And just being together. But our mission is outside of ourselves. Our mission is to others. And that's why missions and evangelism is so important, because we are not just here to build ourselves up. We are going to have eternity together, okay, with glorious worship that I can't even imagine how incredible it will be when we don't have sin and when we have all the things that God has prepared for us. But our true mission is to tell others. And the way that Zephaniah is saying it, gather together before the day passes. And the real message is going to be verse 3. But let me mention one other thing, too. Notice that he says shameless nation. Now, there's a problem there in the Hebrew word. Once in a while, I'll leave you with a Hebrew issue again. But anyway, there's a possibility that word is not shameless, but actually unwanted. That's a possibility. Now, that's a stronger way of doing it, but there's a word there that can mean wanted or desired, a nation not desired, a nation not wanted, which both are true. I mean, they are shameless in terms of their sin, but also because of what they have done in essentially getting rid of all of God's commands and following him, they are unwanted. They're unwanted not only by the Lord, but they're unwanted by everyone else too. Ezekiel kind of emphasizes this, that they go after all the other nations, hoping that the other nations will care, but then ultimately the other nations just brutalize them, use them, and leave them for dead, essentially. And so they have no one other than the Lord who is going to care about them. And remember, what we're talking about are those who have been called by the Lord. So we're talking not just the nation itself, but those who are connected to his covenants, connected to the truth. So what's the message? What, before the decree takes effect, before that day is gone, verse 3, seek the Lord, all you humble of the land, who do his just commands. Seek righteousness. Seek humility. Perhaps you may be hidden on the day of the anger of the Lord. Now, the scariest term in that whole thing is perhaps. That is always used. Actually, it's either perhaps or it's who knows. In the Old Testament, you have those two phrases. And they're kind of leaving it open because it's God's will and he is in charge. So is it a guarantee that if you're faithful to the Lord, he will save you from all things? You know, that you will not be put to death. You will not be tortured. You will not be persecuted. Things of that nature. There is no guarantee. And there's no guarantee that when this wave of judgment comes through, that even those who are innocent are going to be killed along with those who are guilty. Ezekiel paints a horrific picture in Ezekiel 9. Of a death angel, just like Exodus, coming through with a sword, and this is the command that the Lord gives: kill every man, woman, and child in the city. And that's what the Babylonians will do. But it's, you know, is there any chance that there can be deliverance from that? Yes, there is, but the perhaps needs to remain. That needs to remain because it's the Lord. However, what is the command? What the chances are much, much greater. Let's just say probabilities for the moment. The chances are so much greater that deliverance will come if you're following the Lord during that event. There were a lot of sermons that were preached in the, especially early 20th century, maybe leading into wars and out of wars and all of that. We used to call them hellfire and brimstone preachers, but the ones that, you know, would scare everybody to, you better get right with the Lord because he's coming back, you know. And we've lost some of that. I don't hear too much of that, and I recognize there might have been a little too much of it in some places, but that message is still there. I mean, the message is get your lives right because the Lord is coming back. He sees, he knows, he already understands if there's hypocrisy going on, especially in his own people, among his own people. And when he comes back, it is not going to be pleasant for those who are playing the hypocrite. And so that still is a message we need to know. But this is the positive message. All the humble ones, who are the humble ones? The ones who recognize that they are not in charge, that they are not proud and arrogant and self-centered. You know, one of the chief characteristics, I try to tell people this in academics, okay, because academia is loaded with a lot of arrogant people. people who get one little thing that they know and they think they know everything. But even college students, I try to emphasize to them, because they have a tendency to go back to their churches and saying, oh, they're not doing it right because of what I've heard. And it's like, humility. That is the characteristic of Christ. Philippians 2, let this mind be in you that is also in Christ Jesus. And humility is the focus. Well, this is the focus here, always, always. People who are truly following the Lord will be humble people. They will not be arrogant. They will not be proud. And notice what you're seeking. You seek the Lord, which means that you're interested in what He thinks and what He wants and what He desires. But in the process of that, you're also seeking the characteristics that are connected to the Lord. Righteousness, which we use that term, sometimes we don't define it. I mean, it is connected to justice. That word is connected to that. That means doing right to others as well. Basically, loving your neighbor, loving one another, but it's essentially thinking of others more than yourself, which leads to the second one, which is seek humility. That's, if you are seeking the things that are true and the things that are right, then perhaps you may be hidden in the day of judgment. Now, we have a promise by the Lord. Actually, Jesus made it even stronger, that those who are faithful to Him, those who know Him, will be saved. We will be delivered. But the problem is that God pays attention. The Lord pays attention to those even who claim His name. He pays attention to them to such a degree that if we are not humble, if we are oppressive, if we do allow our sin to come into, let's call it, into the camp, into His community, He will pay attention. I was teaching somewhere else, and I had to deal with, I'm going through the book of Acts with another group, and Ananias and Sapphira. And that should terrify us, just to know this was in the church period. This wasn't Old Testament-like. I mean, people always say, oh, that's Old Testament. It's like, no, it's New Testament too. You know, they lied about what they gave. And it didn't take Peter or any of the other apostles to deal with it. God dealt with it. And He does pay attention. Now, next verse I gotta watch, because since this is in the news all the time, everybody's gonna be thinking modern day, but I wanna take you back to its context. Verse 4, for Gaza shall be deserted and Ashkelon shall become a desolation. Ashdod's people shall be driven out at noon and Ekron shall be uprooted. The first one you've probably all heard, Gaza. But those are four of the five Philistine cities from the ancient world. There's an interesting phenomenon that takes place in the prophets. The early prophets mentioned the fifth city. The fifth city is Gath. That's not mentioned here. But the later prophets only mention four. So usually the speculation is Gath is gone by this point. Now, I will tell you another thing. The Philistines are gone by this point. So that means that these cities are not just the Philistines. You know, that's like Goliath and the time of David, and really by after David's time, the Philistines are no more. The cities are still there, but not the Philistines. So these cities become symbolic. And I would say that all of what we're going to read here is symbolic, which means they will apply to our time as well. Because once you start employing symbolism, that means that it can carry itself out of its context and then move forward. So the Philistine cities, now the Philistines were known as, you know, the terrors of their time. You can read about that. Remember when Saul and David are even, well, Saul's chasing David all over the place, the Philistines are coming in and taking advantage of it. So they represent a people group that are against the Lord, fighting against Him, fighting against His people. And so this is really a prophecy that He will deal with those who are against His own people. And that should be a comfort to those who are His people, that yes, He's going to deal with the outsider. This is an interesting passage, this whole passage here, because I've mentioned this to you before, and one of the reasons I want to do Zephaniah after we finish Genesis 1 through 11 is 6 through 11, Genesis 6 through 11, from the flood all the way to the tower, we have Zephaniah taking that material, reworking it, but putting it in the context of prophecy. And so the flood, I will sweep away everything. I will deal with all of humanity. That language is in chapter 1. So what's going on in chapter 2? Well, chapter 2 mentions nations and people groups. And if you go back, we do not have the time today, but if you go back to Genesis 10, that's that list of nations. There are three things that are primarily emphasized in that nation history. Of course, you're dealing with the three sons, the Japheth and then Ham and then Shem in that order. But in Japheth's category, you have an emphasis on the coastal cities, the cities of the seacoast. That is an emphasis. So when man is spreading after the flood, Japheth's descendants become the seacoast peoples. In their context, it would have been all that Mediterranean area, especially the northern part of the Mediterranean. So Greeks, Romans, all of that, that group. And by the way, Genesis 10, it's obvious that that would have been put together even after Moses' time because they have nations and peoples that even Moses wouldn't have known. I mean, much, much later. So it's showing us that all three, the three sons, Japheth, Ham, Shem, that's the order in that chapter, from them all of the nations came. So the seacoast peoples is one of the points of emphasis. Another point of emphasis is the Cushites, which is a little weird. I guess it's because Nimrod is the son of Cush, so Nimrod becomes very important, but Cush seems to be emphasized. You would think Egypt. You know, if I were going to pick one of the nations of that category, I'd say Egypt, not Cush. And Cush, people say it's present-day Ethiopia, but it was bigger than that. It might have even included Egypt. It might have been more of a region rather than just a nation. But it's certainly down in that area of Africa, but that's another point of emphasis. Then the other point of emphasis in Genesis 10 is going to the east in the Mesopotamian area, you have Nineveh. Nineveh's emphasized. So I want you to see what Zephaniah is doing. Okay, he's already got people's minds in Genesis. He's already got them on the flood. Now he's going to mention nations, and the only place that we have the mention of nations in that sequence is chapter 10. So it is as if this chapter is now echoing chapter 10. You have the mention of these Philistine cities, but now notice, woe to you inhabitants of the seacoast. That sounds familiar. Well, maybe not. You'd have to read back in Genesis 10, but that's a point of emphasis. You nation of the Kerethites, that is a Hebrew way of talking about Crete. If you know about Crete, that's that island that is in the Mediterranean. The assumption, it seems, in Scripture and also in ancient history is that these seacoast peoples, especially the ones who inhabited the east side of the Mediterranean, came from Crete. So there's an assumption that the Philistines came from Crete. The Canaanites, most likely, came from Crete originally. So there are all these sea peoples, these seacoast peoples. When you read about them in other works in the ancient world, they're almost like the Vikings. Or even worse, pirates. I mean, they kind of come in, they destroy, and then they plunder and they leave. But the sea peoples, they probably came from that part of the Mediterranean. So anyhow, but you nation of the Kerethites, but I want you to notice he's connecting the Crete to Canaan. The word of the Lord is against you, O Canaan, land of the Philistines, and I will destroy you until no inhabitant is left. Now, please know that in Zephaniah's time, the Canaanites are not a big group or, you know, they're mixed in. Philistines are no more. So this is all symbolic. He's talking about these people groups who have come in and invaded. And they represent those who are against God's people. If they know their history, they know the history of the Canaanites. They know the history of the Philistines. But if you go back to Genesis 10, the Canaanites are coming from Ham's son, Canaan, who is cursed. Remember that. So this is connecting to all of that. And you, O sea coast, shall be pastures with meadows for shepherds and folds for flocks. The sea coast shall become the possession of the remnant of the house of Judah on which they shall graze. In the houses of Ashkelon they shall lie down at evening, for the Lord their God will be mindful of them and restore their fortunes. Now, this transformation that takes place from a seacoast city that is known for trade and commerce and is just a powerful city, becoming a pasture for sheep, that's clearly judgment language. You're taking what man has developed against God and turning it back into not quite a Garden of Eden, but it's certainly turned into something that is not significant from man's perspective. It is from God's, but it's not from man. So this reversal that takes place. Here's something that we need to keep in mind, that we, in fact, in the ancient world, this was very common too, especially in the Greek period, marveling at all the works of man. You remember there was this thing called the seven wonders of the ancient world. You know the only one that exists now is the oldest pyramid in Egypt. But there were all of these wonders of the ancient world where people would go and just in awe, just be amazed. But they are no more. And all of the things that we have built, and this kind of leads to the tower, but all the things that we have built to try to take full control of our own society, of our own place, those things will be gone. You've seen probably movies that are, what do they call them? They're not apocalyptic movies, but they're, where the disaster but future, you know. And then the world's just a devastation and everybody's just running around trying to get food. Huh? Well, that's Planet of the Apes could be one of them. I'm thinking there are a lot of them that are like that. Well, this is the language of Scripture, that God is going to take all of those things that we are so proud of and that we are so focused on because we think that we're in charge, and he's going to turn them into something else. But he's going to take the humble, the ones who are devoted to him, that are not building the strong edifices, he's going to take them and they will inherit those places. To say that you're going to lie down like in peace in Ashkelon is not something anyone would have thought of in ancient times. But again, I'm telling you that these cities, I mean, they're there, but they're not Philistine anymore. So this is symbolic. It's talking about God dealing with all of the things that man has built and put together. And so this is, you should be thinking the tower anyway, Genesis 11, even before you get to there, to the place where it's going to be obvious. Verse 8, I have heard the taunts of Moab and the revilings of the Ammonites, how they have taunted my people and made boasts against their territory. Therefore, as I live, declares the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Moab shall become like Sodom, and the Ammonites like Gomorrah. Moab and Ammon were those two nations on the east side of the Jordan. But from the Ammonites, we have Milcom. We have the one that where you're sacrificing children. There's a chance the Moabites did the same thing. And I know we have some good Moabites in Scripture. You have Ruth, okay? So there are Moabites. She actually becomes part of the Messianic line. But they're the ones who tormented Israel all throughout its history. So he says, a land possessed by nettles and salt pits and a waste forever. That's not even going to become pasture land. It's just going to become desolation. And when I think salt pits, I'm thinking Sodom and Gomorrah area, Dead Sea. If you've ever been there, you know, it's not a salt pit, but it's a big salt lake. So The remnant of my people shall plunder them, and the survivors of my nation shall possess them. This shall be their lot in return for what? Notice what the target is. Their pride. Again, this is leading us to that tower image. Because they taunted and boasted against the people of the Lord of hosts. The Lord will be awesome against them. I don't ever like that translation nowadays because the word awesome is kind of not so awesome anymore, but, you know, awe-inspiring, something like that. For he will famish all the gods of the earth. That means he's starving them. How are gods starved? No more sacrifices, no more worship. There was this thought that the gods ate. And so if you don't bring them their food, they starve. So God will starve them all. They will not be worshiped anymore. I think in terms of, and I know I'm jumping in all kinds of places, but Caesarea Philippi, when the Lord said, upon this rock I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. If you ever visit that site, there's a giant cave that the ancients called the Gate of Hell. And over that cave was a temple that was used for sacrificing to the god Pan. Okay, so, yeah, the flute one, yeah. Anyway, the god Pan, that was the temple for Pan. And they would take sacrifices in there and kill them, and the blood would flow into a river that would go underground and then come out the other side. And I can't remember what I think the idea is that if you see the blood coming out the other side, then the god has accepted it. I would have thought that it would have been reverse. God would take the blood. But anyway, so there's some sort of weird thing. Well, when Jesus was there, that temple was still there. You don't see it nowadays. But when he says, upon this rock, and he says, the gates of hell, the gates of Hades will not prevail against it, he's not talking about some general thing. He's talking about those world religions, that will not conquer what he is starting. And if you notice, and usually good tour guides who are Christian, at least, they'll usually do this. They'll say, and you'll notice that temple's not there anymore, but the church still is. So anyhow, that's what God is doing. That's how he deals with the other gods. He doesn't tell everybody, well, they don't exist. He doesn't do that throughout the Old Testament. He taunts them. He plays with them. It's like a lion playing with prey before killing it, and then kills them. And to him shall bow down each in its place all the lands of the nations. That is universal. That's talking about the Lord will be worshipped by others. Now, I told you about Cush. Okay, maybe this is an honorable mention, but please note, verse 12, you also, O Cushites, shall be slain by my sword. I'm thinking Zephaniah is thinking through Genesis 10, and it's like Cush is important, Nimrod, all of that. Ultimately, Nimrod is the one that's responsible for Nineveh, so Nineveh becomes an issue. So let's get those Cushites in the text before we say this. And he will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria. And he will make Nineveh a desolation, a dry waste like the desert. Now, I want to tell you that during Zephaniah's time, the Babylonians were in charge. Okay? Assyria was not really a major power by this point. However, in Josiah's day, it was right before the destruction of Nineveh. 612 BC is the destruction of Nineveh. 605 is when the Babylonians come into Judah for the first time, but 612. So this is most likely being written right before that, Josiah's period. And in fact, that would really bring it to mind when Nineveh is destroyed by the Medes and the Babylonians. The Medes were a strange group because they always tagged along whoever they thought the winner would be. So, you know, they tagged along with the Babylonians to destroy Assyria. When the Persians decided they were going to go after the Babylonians, they tagged along with Persia, so mercenaries, you know. So anyway, so they destroyed, so Nineveh is going to be destroyed, and herds shall lie down in her midst, all kinds of beasts, even the owl and the hedgehog shall lodge in her capitals. This is so weird. I appreciate what ESV is doing on this, but a voice shall hoot in the window. You had a mention of owls, so yeah, you get hooting now. Devastation will be on the threshold, for her cedar work will be laid bare. So now it's an habitation for the animals. This is all through the Old Testament on judgment speeches, that what used to be a palace of a king is now a place where the hedgehogs dwell. You know, actually, it's a lot of times it's hyenas and, you know, but owls, but the hooting owl, I think Zephaniah is the only one who has that. Verse 15. This is the exultant city that lives securely, that said in her heart, I am and there is no one else. What a desolation she has become, a lair for wild beasts. Everyone who passes by her hisses and shakes his fist. We're talking about Nineveh there. But I want you to know the radical shift. Look at chapter 3. Woe to her who is rebellious and defiled, the oppressing city. Oh, you think you're still talking about Nineveh, don't you? But notice, she listens to no voice, she accepts no correction, she does not trust in the Lord, she does not draw near to her God. Ah, we have just ended the destruction of Nineveh, and now we're back in Jerusalem again. Because remember, this is his group, this is the audience that he's talking to. Because here's what happens. People look at the judgment on others and they think, oh, yes, God, oh, yeah, you know, the cheering section. But then when he turns and comes to us, it's a whole different story. And generally, the way that he operates is he goes after his own first and then to the other nations. That's how we see it time and again. But Zephaniah is doing it this way because we have that table of nations in Genesis 10. And it focuses on the tower of Genesis 11, which is all about pride. It's all about human independence against God and rebellion against God. And so he focuses his attention to the destruction of Nineveh because of the pride. And now it's Jerusalem, the oppressing city. The one who won't even draw close to her own God. Her officials within her are roaring lions. Her judges are even evening wolves that leave nothing till the morning. Her prophets are fickle, treacherous men. Her priests profane what is holy. They do violence to the law. But notice this contrast. The Lord within her is righteous. He does no injustice. This is why God has to judge his own people, because the association with his people and his character is tight. His name is connected to his people. And if there is injustice among his people, he does not let that go on. But of course, what Zephaniah is saying here is the Lord is righteous. He's not the one doing the injustice, because that's what people think. Oh, they're your people doing all of this. That must be you. No, that is not me. And how are you going to prove that it's not you? Judging them and dealing with them. Oh, they're your own house. Yes, they're your own kids. But you deal with them to show that you are not connected.